Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Hi, Al.
Hey, no, will not stand for that. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've done podcasts on three consecutive good movies. The Silence of the Lambs was last week. Gone Girl was the week before, and Three Kings was before that. And then we had a little bit of an argument about the one before, which is The Fugitive. But you can decide for yourself. But yeah, and also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. Subscribe to us on iTunes, and tell your friends about us. Write handwritten notes like Steven Spielberg would about how good our podcast is, and send them out to your friends. But yeah, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. Follow us on Facebook, and let's get
it. Small scenes, the fragments of the mirror. You remember those?
Vaguely.
What do you remember?
There's a room, and I sit there alone, always alone.
What else?
Grave.
Where?
I don't know. It's an open grave, and I stand by the gravestone looking down into it. It's my grave.
But how do you know?
I know.
But is there a name on the gravestone?
No. No, it's new and clean and waiting.
What else?
James.
Yep.
What are we talking about?
Vertigo.
Okay.
Hopefully we keep up the streak of good movies.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Neither of us has watched the movie yet. This is purely a speculation podcast.
No, that's a lie. We've seen this. Have you seen this movie a lot?
I think I've probably seen it about six times.
Okay. Do you like it? How do you feel about it?
I like it a lot. I think I find it very bizarre how many, I don't know. I feel like my reaction to it is always kind of based on where I am in my life when I watch it in a way that's different from a lot of movies. Not totally unique, but, I don't know. It just, sometimes it's just really, a really entertaining movie and really pretty movie. And sometimes it makes me feel gross, like, so.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Well, okay, actually, let's back this up. 1958, Vertigo.
Yep.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Also correct.
What other Hitchcock have we talked about?
Rear Window.
That's it?
Yeah. And Disturbia.
Right.
Definitely directed by Alfred Hitchcock.
Yep.
Definitely not DJ Caruso.
Starring James Stewart and Kim Novak.
Yes.
Based on a French novel by French people.
Okay,
that's all. They're
getting real freedom fries on us here.
That's right. Okay, so you like it?
Yeah.
I guess
tell me why you think this movie is more fun to think about than it is to watch.
Is that what I'm gonna say?
I assume that's sort of my feeling.
No, I've a long complicated relationship with Vertigo.
Okay.
No, sometimes I like it a lot, and then sometimes I don't like it very much at all.
Fair enough.
And as I'm sure we'll talk about later, this is sometimes called one of the best movies ever, sometimes called the best movie ever.
Mm-hmm.
So that always makes a movie watching experience pretty loaded, because I remember the first time seeing this, knowing it was a big deal. And kind of not really knowing how to watch movies at that point anyway,
mm-hmm.
It really didn't blow me away. And there's things about it that I liked, and there's things about it that I continue to like, and there's some things about it that I don't like. But then there's some other elements that we'll touch on later that I've been back and forth on and still don't know completely where I stand, or at least I know that my opinion will probably change in 2 weeks from now anyway.
Yeah.
So I can't say that I love, love, love this movie, because I'm certainly ambivalent about often key points of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But to someone who hasn't seen it, who I think has a decent taste in movies, I would recommend watching it for sure. And there's tons of stuff in here, as you rightly predicted, to think about and consider. But yeah, it's a difficult one for me. I don't know. I know that's such a cop out of an answer, but
no, it's fine. I mean, the pace isn't exactly blistering, and I mean, we've talked about it before on the podcast, or at least I know I've mentioned it. I like movies that sort of set up this world that leaves a lot of space for you to do your own thinking in, and sort of piece together the movie as it's happening, and a movie that leaves you with that sort of time to think while it's going on and still kind of keeps you on your toes as to what it's trying to be about, I find really fascinating.
Yeah, and on that same token,
we discussed a lot of that with The Shining, I think. That's sort of like leaving space for thought.
Yeah, and even Gone Girl, we kind of talked about how at times it's kind of extreme and some things aren't really believable, but you give that a pass because that's not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is more kind of the questions of human nature that it deals with. And
like the whole murder plot of this movie is that, you know,
that's what I mean when I said earlier about something so central being not perfectly executed, or at least I go back and forth on whether or not it's executed well or it's executed very poorly. Yes, just like Gone Girl, the murder and the whodunit and kind of the details of the crime that's central to the plot is really not the biggest thing this movie has to offer.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, things like that kind of operate like a fable sometimes. And sometimes watching this movie, the things that need to be given a pass, I have a really hard time giving a pass to. Okay. And often those are very pivotal moments. And, you know, just for example, the nun coming out of the bell tower at the end and just standing there and ringing a bell after someone's just been killed. It just doesn't. Sorry for this one. Ring true to me. Mm. But then again, sometimes it's I catch myself thinking that and I tell myself, well, that's not the point of this movie at all. But if I find it that distracting in the moment, it's really hard for me to enjoy the experience of sitting through this movie for all of it.
All right. Well, I certainly think that that moment is not the best executed version of what they want to get out of it. But I think, I don't know, I'm going to give it a pass. You know, I think what that moment gets to is just great, you know, and I don't know, seeming lack of grace into how it's executed. I don't know. I'm fine with it. I don't care.
Okay, yeah, and we've discussed how things like that get a pass as long as you hit all these thematic things on the head. Okay, let's back this up once again. Okay. Now that we've discussed the almost ending of the movie.
Yeah. No, that's basically the ending of the movie. There's 20 seconds left after the thing we just talked about.
Yeah, and I have some problem with Hitchcock endings sometimes as well.
Oh, this one's great.
Ties into it. Do you know about the 5 lost Hitchcock movies?
Yeah. There were some that were taken out of circulation for I don't know the reason, but I know that Hitchcock's sort of re-criticizing of this movie or re-critiquing of this movie that sort of led to its stature is starts in about 1983 when those 5 movies were released. I know Vertigo is one of them. The Man Who Knew Too Much is one of them. And I don't remember. Oh, Rope is probably one of the other ones too. And yeah, they were just sort of re-released after he died.
Yeah, Rope and The Trouble with Harry, which I will definitely forgive you for not remembering.
Is Rear Window the 5th?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I guess what he did was took back the rights or something, or raised made it a really hefty fee to run these in theaters. So I guess it was still possible to, but his fee was just so exorbitant that no theater would be able to make money off it. And he gave the rights to his daughter. Mm-hmm. And then like, that was kind of, you know, I guess a gift to make sure, you know, she had these properties of movies, you know, some of which were very successful. So this should be a way for her to, you know, generate some money after he dies. So they went out of distribution in 1968. And then, yeah, in October 1983, as you said, Rear Window and Vertigo were re-released. And yeah, this obviously Hitchcock was well appreciated in his time and immediately after, but Vertigo was not when it came out.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't like it was a hated movie. It made money, but it didn't make as much money as most Hitchcock movies. And it was more divisive than the average Hitchcock film. But it's not like it was roundly hated. It's not like it was the best of me, the new Nicholas Sparks movie that everybody hated. It was just divisive. Whereas Hitchcock movies very rarely were divisive.
Yeah. Yeah, he was just very consistent up until that point. So yeah, it's not as though it bombed. It's not as though nobody liked it, but it is far from appreciated the way that it is appreciated now.
Yeah, and I mean Hitchcock has publicly discussed things he doesn't like about this movie. So, you know, it's it was divisive at the time to the people making it.
Right. And I think one of the kind of the biggest ones for him was James Stewart.
Yeah.
He blamed him largely for the kind of somewhat failure of this movie, or at least the disappointment to normal Hitchcock standard,
which is kind of silly because he cast Jimmy Stewart, you know.
Yeah, he's casted him a bunch, and then he casted him again, and he kept, you know, he I guess was fine enough with his performance to keep that footage and move on to the next scene. So yeah, that seems a little kind of underhanded, but
yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about this movie.
I'm into it.
You said earlier you like kind of how fun and colorful it is to look at.
Oh my god, yeah.
That's, even knowing what I know about this movie, and even knowing what I know about some of the other Hitchcock movies in color that I've seen, the second scene, like, we'll just ignore kind of that intro scene of words coming out of an unknown woman's eyes.
I mean, we have to talk about it at some point.
We will.
Okay.
Just the colors, his office, his Galvin Elster's office, just blow me away every time.
The first scene in Ernie's is the one that gets me.
Right, with the cranes going in the background and the water and everything?
No, the restaurant Ernie's.
Oh, right.
Yeah, where we get our introduction to Madeline, you know, air quotes Madeline.
Sure.
That's the, and the shot, the first shot within that restaurant is so striking.
What's the shot? Great.
It's where we see Johnny, Scotty, John sitting at the bar, and he's just looking over in the direction of where Madeline and Gavin, that's his name, right?
Yes, Gavin Elster.
Yep. Yeah, are sitting having dinner, and the whole room and the chairs are all red, and like this red just pops, and we get sort of this camera move that for 1958 must have been considered extremely impressive. Get this dolly back from away from Scotty, and then we get a bit of a pan over to where Madeline's sitting, and it dollies in a bit towards that table, and she's wearing green in the sea of red, and it's this very bright, wonderful green, and it really pops. And yeah, that's one of my favorite shots in the movie. I think that setup of that scene and those introductions are really well done, or Scotty's introduction to Madeline is very well done.
Yeah. I think it's the office scenes that I would take over that one. Okay. I like that. And one thing I do like about this movie that you've described in that scene is just very deliberate camera movements, mm-hmm. which obviously in the '50s and a lot of Hitchcock work were not, you know, steady cam, shaky cam kind of stuff.
Yeah. Steadicam was still 20 years away from existing.
That wasn't even a possibility, yeah. But just the very kind of slow paced movement of the cameras in scenes, it seems like it's barely moving at times, but it's just quick, very intentional, very deliberate. And yeah, it's, I mean, you see it in a lot of film from this period, but along with kind of those scenes I was describing, just the depth of some of the sets they use, and just all these different colors, and they're all just so so bright and vivid. Like, this, as someone who doesn't usually care as much about the visuals, that's something that just stuns me from in the first like 10 minutes of watching this movie, and it never really goes away. But it's just watching this for the first time, or watching it from the beginning, I'm always stunned by how just rich and vivid the picture looks. And that's something I kind of always forget about when I watch a movie that's, you know, 50, 60 years old now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk more about that restaurant scene at Ernie's.
Okay.
Anything else besides kind of that camera movement that you like in the kind of green on red juxtaposition?
Well, I like when Madeline and Gavin get up to leave, how Madeline stops right in front of right in front of Scotty, and Scotty sees her, but we see sort of what I suspect is a POV shot from Scotty's perspective of Madeline, but it's this sort of perfect profile shot. It's like right on the side, the camera's pointed directly at the side of her face.
Yeah.
And that's a really stark way to shoot a character. I assume that type of shot, I mean, that shot, it's not like it's used a lot now, but particularly for the time, that shot must have really stuck out as being something that just isn't done. And the reason it's not done is because you can only see half of the face. And so he's kind of only seeing half of Madeline. And I feel like that's kind of important to the movie. He's not seeing this whole person. He's just seeing the half that's from his perspective, from his point of view. And I think that that interaction is very important.
Yeah, and you don't realize it at the time because you don't know about kind of the double identities and just the plot that ties into that kind of shot is not mm-hmm. really apparent at that moment.
Exactly. And there are a couple other profile shots throughout the movie as well that sort of continue their representation.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch that I noticed. And I was trying to watch, so maybe I missed a few. But James Stewart always seems to be looking to the right of the screen. Mm-hmm. And Kim Novak's always looking left. And just watching that intro again, because I kind of watched that scene in Ernie's just to see if I was right about these profile shots before I went on and on about my reading into them.
Yeah.
He's always looking to the right. And as you said, when she walks up behind him, his back's to her, cause he's kind of at the bar and she was in the, you know, seating area. So we have him looking to the right and he's always looking over, to the right, even when he's looking at her at the dinner table and she's looking left. And then he, kind of by the corner of his eye kind of follows as she walks behind him. And then we get that really perfect, you know, complete, as you said, 90 degree profile shot. And she's very big in the frame and she's looking off to the left. And as she's walking behind him, he almost turns his head to look over his left shoulder. So he would be looking left for the first time mm-hmm. when he's always been looking right. And we've always had her looking left mm-hmm. and he doesn't do it. He kind of like peeks over a bit, but we never get that profile shot. We never have him fully looking that way. And I think that just ties in perfectly with what you said of them never really kind of looking the same way, never really knowing him not knowing the true nature of her at this point. And I feel like if he could look left, it would be kind of like, oh, this is an understanding. It's kind of grasp.
Sorry, it's what?
It's just kind of grasping who this person is and who mm-hmm. like the real identity of this character. And we get that he wants to. We see that he just kind of barely peeks over his shoulder, but never turns his neck fully, never gets that profile shot. And it's, again, rewatching it, it's this moment where it's an attempt to know her. It's a desire for him to understand this person, but an inability to or an unwillingness to. Mm-hmm. And that's something we get later in the movie is the question of, does he want to know her? Is he willing to? Can he? Or is he happy just to kind of mold people into who he wants them to be? But kind of getting ahead of myself on that one.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that Jimmy Stewart was not an ambi-turner.
No, clearly not.
Just in summation. Yeah. You're putting Jimmy Stewart's neck turning abilities on blast right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you like Jimmy Stewart in this movie?
There's something about Jimmy Stewart that I mean, part of it is through my own doing that I could just never take seriously. I think he's important to the movie. I think Hitchcock is wrong in saying that Jimmy Stewart is the reason for this movie's failure, which is insane, I think, because I think his placement in this movie adds so much thematically.
His performance or
his no, not his, his performance, but the fact that Jimmy Stewart is the guy playing John.
Okay, I think it's what's that bring to it?
I mean, it's the Jimmy Stewart thing. He was the everyman, you know. He was fought in multiple wars. He was the everyday American hero. He was the country bumpkin that went to Washington and joined the Senate, you know. That last one was a film role. And yeah. Hitchcock, basically every movie that he did with Jimmy Stewart played off of the persona that Jimmy Stewart had established over the 30s and 40s, where he's in movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and It's a Wonderful Life. And It's a Wonderful Life is Jimmy Stewart's favorite movie, which I think says a lot about the type of person Jimmy Stewart was and also the type of roles he enjoyed playing. And so Hitchcock would put him in these positions where it was just kind of seeing Jimmy Stewart do something different than what you expect him to do. It was like when Tom Hanks was in Road to Tom Hanks always got compared to Jimmy Stewart, particularly in the 90s. And when Tom Hanks was cast in Road to Perdition playing a character that was morally gray for the first time, it was kind of a big deal, you know? And, or at least that's how it was talked about. And that's what Hitchcock did with Jimmy Stewart. And Vertigo is, I think, the weirdest we see Jimmy Stewart get, because he's such a gross person in this movie. and I think that's why his casting is so important, is that every person can be this gross, you know, because Jimmy Stewart is every person.
Right. And it's a case of immediately having sympathy with the protagonist. Like we feel bad for Jimmy Stewart off the get-go, because, you know, he in a way is responsible for a cop dying.
Yeah, you know, cop did make some poor decisions, though.
No, I agree 100%, but yeah. You see what I mean. Like, you're set up to feel sympathy with this guy, because not only did he feels guilty for someone dying, now he's unable to have this job that he seemed to like, at least. He develops an intense fear of height that causes problems in many areas of his life. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of just confined to hanging out with Midge for a bit, which isn't so bad. But I just mean, we, like most protagonists, we're supposed to identify with him and feel bad for anything bad that happens to him. And as this movie progresses, it's just difficult to watch what he becomes, because that's supposed to be, you know, us in the movie. Mm-hmm. And yes, he absolutely becomes gross and controlling and demanding and abusive and, you know, all these awful things. And it's difficult to watch, you know, your main character go down that road and become something you don't like. But mm-hmm. I think that is very much so helped by the fact that it is Jimmy Stewart. Like, yeah. It is this guy that we know is such a great guy from all these movies and seemingly from his real life. I think that is one thing I do enjoy about this movie, is that, taking a main character that we begin to sympathize with slowly down this dark path and like him less and less.
Yeah, absolutely. One quick note that, I mean, it bears no relation to this movie at all. I just want to mention it because I feel like you'd enjoy it. He flew as a non-duty observer on a bombing mission in Vietnam. Isn't that crazy?
Why would he do that?
Because he loved the army. Highly decorated in the army, and staunch conservative, and was a big supporter of the Vietnam War. And just in the late 60s, he's like, let's go on a bombing mission.
So I guess he just wasn't physically fit, but wanted to go anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it worked. I didn't read too much into it, but I don't know. That whole fact is just so crazy to me.
That's pretty
and in true Jimmy Stewart fashion, didn't want it to be publicized, but it got out eventually.
Oh, that's great. Good for you, Jimmy Stewart. okay, so now we have Jimmy Stewart, a.k.a. Scott John Jack, following around Carlita. Or do you want to talk at all about him, his visit with Gavin in that office?
No.
I've talked about it. I really
don't have a lot. Every scene involving Gavin is one of the scenes I find the least interesting to think about, because most of those scenes are plot heavy. And the, I mean, like we've mentioned, the plot in this movie doesn't make sense, you know, and it's not the thing I care about. And a writer I like a lot once said that Gavin's idea would be more sense, like it would make more sense if he had just murdered every single person he had ever met. Like that would make the plot make more sense than this movie.
Do you want to get into your issues with the plot, or should we move on?
No, because I don't care. They don't bother me at all, because I think what it gets me is great. I'm totally okay with it, and the movie it's not like the movie focuses on the plot a lot, so I never really think about it. I think Gavin's off in Europe at the end of the movie, and but I don't care at all, and I'm fine with that. You know, he's ostensibly the villain of this movie, but I think the fact that that's not really clear is what kind of what makes Vertigo awesome.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's, since we talked about plot, since I brought her up, let's talk about Midge a bit.
Okay.
Because she basically, I think from my understanding of how this was written, she was kind of just plugged in to be an exposition device.
Hmm.
Because Scotty doesn't really have anyone to talk to other than, you know, Gavin and Judy, who are just too involved in the story for, you know, from a screenplay perspective, to get the things out that he needs to be established about himself.
Mm-hmm.
So their first scene is just a ton of exposition saying kind of who he is, what he does, how everyone in this movie knows each other and what they've been up to for the past few years.
And a reinforcement that his vertigo is still a problem.
Yes, very much a problem.
Yeah.
Yes, to the point he can't get onto like the third step of a stepladder inside.
Yeah. No, that was a weird chair.
Okay, yes, that was a weird chair. Weird yellow chair.
It was the 50s. It's a different time. Greatest generation.
That's right.
When chairs were built right.
Okay, so since she is kind of... Well, actually, so what do you think? Is she all plot, or is there more to Midge in this movie?
There is more to Midge in this movie, not a lot. I think the idea is that we're supposed to be able to... It's a thing that we see... or Midge is somebody that we're able to see John enjoying spending his time with, but not wanting to make it a romantic thing, because he knows Midge. And, you know, he mentions that they were potentially engaged in the past, but he seems to be unsure, which is just weird phrasing.
And awfully rude.
Well, yeah. And then we see that that apparently she was the one to call it off, and Midge seems to regret that. And I think her regret is interesting, because then you have to think about her ideas between why she would have called it off back then and why she regrets it now. And I think that does eventually tie into Johnny's story and adds a nice little layer that's not incredibly important to the movie. It just sort of adds another wrinkle to the plot that I enjoy. But there are things that make that kind of weird. She refers to herself as mother later on, which is odd. And then she just kind of disappears for the last 45 minutes or so, which, again, I don't have a problem with. But I think that what she adds to the movie is more than just exposition.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What about from a performance standpoint?
I mean, they could have cut out of the scene with the painting a bit earlier. But other than that, I think she's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I really like her, and I think her performance is good. I think early on she's just not given much to do other than exposition. I think she still kind of does a good job with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an entertaining scene. The first scene after the prologue is entertaining, despite the fact that it's 5 minutes of exposition and or standing on weird chairs.
Right. I just find her kind of to be the well, she's seemingly the only nice person in this movie, but that's not that interesting.
Yeah.
Of anyone who says more than 10 lines, she's the only one who doesn't do something I would consider awful.
Okay. She stalks her friend, which is a little weird.
Yeah, it's a little weird, isn't it?
It's more than a little weird. I was being polite.
Okay. I just think she's... I think the only relatable character in the movie, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's sort of the whole point. Once you get to know John, he's not relatable because at least you hope he's not relatable because he's horrible. But yeah, the movie is meant to show Midge as a relatable character. And that's kind of the point. John doesn't want relatable. He wants the unknown.
Yeah. Okay, so it...
Yeah, so like he needs her to not be normal, and then he would be interested.
So she's awesome and great, but actually exists, and that's too much of a,
exactly.
an issue for him.
Absolutely.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so we've done a lot of talking without really getting into the whole Judy Madeline thing.
Yeah.
How do you like how that story kind of unfolds and just, you know, getting that, getting the story from Gavin Alster and then what's a mostly silent, just kind of section of the movie where he just kind of follows her. Like, we don't get dialogue from Kim Novak till about, I think, after the, like, one third of the way into the movie.
Mm-hmm. Basically, so what about, like, just, she probably doesn't talk until after he rescues her from the bay, right?
Yeah. I can't think of when else she would have had to say anything.
Yeah. Well, maybe something very short to Gavin, but I feel like in Ernie's, but I feel like that probably doesn't happen.
Yeah. And if so, I don't think it shows up in the audio recording. Like, gotcha. Maybe we see her lips move, but there's no dialogue to speak of. Mm-hmm. So what do you make of this very silent, substantial part of the movie?
It's wonderful and it's so gross.
Okay, it's gross because he's stalking someone?
Yes.
It's a job.
It is a job, but where it ends up makes it kind of gross in retrospect, you know? Because very quickly he seems, I don't know, maybe it's just when I was watching this movie this time, I just sort of know where it goes, but or knew where it goes. But there's just, I don't know, the important thing is that we see him in the darkness watching this woman that he's supposed to watch. And I'm speaking specifically of some of the shots in the museum where she's sitting and looking at that painting. And we get sort of this framing of him in just outside of the room that she is in the darkness, watching her as she sits and looks at the painting. And the idea is that everybody is kind of longingly staring at something. Even Gavin, off screen, not anywhere near this location, sees a life that he can't have with his wife in the picture. You know, once we know his actual motives, sees a life he can't have with his wife in the picture. So that's what's motivating him to get rid of her, you know? And that's sort of the point of that intro, or not intro, but the first segment of the movie, is to be able to see a character seeing something they don't understand, but knowing that they want to be closer to it. Yeah,
but
and that's why Jimmy Stewart continues to follow, even aside from the job, you know.
But Judy, Kim Novak's character at this point, isn't looking at something she doesn't know. She's pretending to, right?
Yes, exactly. But we don't know that yet.
Right.
We're seeing, like, in the motivation of what we understand the character to be doing at that time, she's seeing something that she wants to be, you know, or thinks she is.
Yeah.
But okay. Wrongfully.
Right. Okay, I got you. Now, what about when they go to, or when she goes into the hotel, the McKittrick Hotel, and Scotty follows her there?
I mean, it's a nice little thing to throw you off and ties in nicely when you know that Madeline and Judy are two different people, because, you know, she's not dressed as Judy when she walks into the hotel that time. And so that's why the door person doesn't recognize her or doesn't see her, which is interesting in retrospect, and also explains why she says, oh, she's not here. You know.
But what about her mysterious escape?
I don't know. Maybe I zoned out.
Okay, well, her car is gone. It's like she was never there in the first place.
Oh yeah, I don't know. I have no reading for that.
Okay, I was just wondering if you thought that like kind of cheap. Once we know the true nature of this character, I don't know. To me, that just seemed like they were trying to build up they were trying to fool the viewer the way that Gavin is trying to fool Scotty at this point.
Okay.
And to say that there's this some kind of supernatural element about his wife that, you know, maybe she is possessed, or maybe her mind's going back and forth, or maybe she really is a ghost and that's why she disappears from this hotel. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know if you thought that might be a cop out to pull one of those on the audience and it's something that never gets explained.
No.
No?
No.
That's something you just
I will go to my it leads somewhere interesting, I don't give a shit defense.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I've done many times with many films and a handful of films recently. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any problem that's too much for you to give a pass to in this movie?
No.
Okay.
I don't know. I just think I don't know. There are times when I would say I'm not 100% engaged. I mean, obviously I probably wasn't during that scene because I didn't think it through fully. I don't know. There's, again, I really enjoy this movie more than I thought I did when I rewatched it. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
how about the reveal? The letter writing scene, the moment it becomes clear to everybody what's been going on the whole time.
I think that is sort of a bit clumsy the way it's told, but I like that it happens there instead of the very end, you know.
Oh, and why?
I just feel like it gives you more time to sort of see just how weird this whole thing is, how weird the situation is that John has allowed himself to enter and then stayed in, and how far he has gone. And it makes the whole thing of him trying to make her into somebody else that we know she is the same person. It makes the whole thing weirder. Mm-hmm. And I think adds a really nice, uncomfortable element to my favorite part of the movie, which is the last third, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Cause I, okay. I'm sick. I'm sorry. I really am.
It's fine.
Cause I always wonder about that reveal. And I think that's something I go back and forth on, because I've discussed on here, I really like twist endings. I think that is a cool point to the movie. I think that's extremely, obviously extremely important, but a very interesting plot point. But it doesn't come kind of where you'd expect it to come. You know, if there you pulled 10 scenes out of a hat and had to try to arrange how this movie takes place, mm-hmm. This is probably the last or second last piece of paper. Mm-hmm. I guess the value of it comes in, you know, maybe you lose a bit of a shock value, and it seems like the last third of the movie, not that it doesn't have a point, but that's, it has lost a lot of steam without this kind of mystery element. Mm-hmm. But I think it lets you stop worrying about that mystery and kind of enjoy what we were getting at the start of this podcast, is that that's not the point of this movie.
Exactly.
The reveal is not the point. It's the heart of the movie somewhere is the themes of like the power of desire and lost love and kind of these more timeless human nature themes.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of, you know, it sort of stops making you care about the what so that you can start thinking about the why, you know? And, like I said about the sort of movies that leave you space to think about them while they're actually ongoing. That's kind of what makes that last section really, really great to me.
It leaves you 33% of the movie to think about.
Exactly. And I mean, again, to go back to Gone Girl, but not to spoil anything for people that haven't seen it yet.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't spoiled anything. It's
okay,
fine.
Good.
It's been very broad. Okay, the first twist in Gone Girl happens much earlier than you would anticipate. And that's sort of where you start looking around for what this movie could actually be about. And there's actually a reference to Vertigo in the novel of Gone Girl that was not used in the film. And it's, I mean, it's very, very apt, you know? And I think that's sort of what changes this movie from the typical Hitchcock movie to Vertigo, the Hitchcock movie that the critics love, right? It's the one that stands out from the bunch because of that reason.
Yeah, I agree. And that is something that, I mean, I'm always back and forth. So to say I agree doesn't mean much. Mm. But it is the thing that allows Judy to be a part of this movie as a person and not just someone who...
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Is not just a pawn in Gavin's scheme, because... it's very, I mean, she's obviously extremely central to the plot for the first two thirds, but you don't really care about her. Like, you want to understand what her deal is, but,
Could you imagine Jimmy Stewart saying, hey, what's your deal?
What's your deal?
Sorry, continue.
No, it's fine. But, you know, she's just kind of, just a blank slate, and intentionally so. I mean, that's part of the whole scheme is for her to be a blank slate. But
yeah, an unknowable mystery woman.
Right. But, and I mean, there's obviously a function of that for that in cinema. And Hitchcock made very good use of these types of female characters throughout much of his career. But that last third, we finally care about her and Scotty at the same time, instead of just care about Scotty's attempt to understand who this woman truly is.
I mean, if anything, the perspective switches and we don't care about Scotty anymore and we care way more about Judy. I think that's kind of where I fit in. And that's why the Scotty starts to feel weird and gross, is because we see Judy as a person with a backstory, person that's had a life, and a person who, like Johnny at the beginning of the movie, it's just in this for a job, and then sort of it becomes something much different and much darker that they are still a part of, you know?
Yeah, I think I care about more both of them more, I guess.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. But I empathize more with Judy, I suppose.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that gives like that reveal kind of 66% of the way through. We see Judy now as someone who suffers and not just someone who deceives.
Mm-hmm.
And we imagine she's involved with something that we don't know for the first while, but now we understand what she is a part of, and she is a victim in a way, because I mean, she did take money to deceive someone in a very, very hurtful manner.
Mm-hmm.
So she's certainly far from entirely innocent, but it is this very unique place that they find themselves at this point in the movie. Mm-hmm. In a very tragic, tragic, unique place. Like, she lies for the money in the beginning to make Scotty fall in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of just as she can no longer exist for Gavin's plot, that's when Scotty kind of is really falling for her.
Yeah.
And then she shows up as Madeline, and Scotty just wants Judy back. Scotty loves someone who doesn't exist. Madeline loves Scotty, but that love will always be unrequited because of her last life as a total lie. Like, it's tragic because no one can possibly be happy from this scenario.
Yeah.
And it's all being controlled by Gavin, who is unseen for most of this movie and never really gets his comeuppance either. And it's just a very, very, very dark closing third to this movie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, throughout the movie, we see characters that can see what they think will make them happy, but not being able to actually get to it themselves. You know, there's always that distance between them, you know, that they're still just stuck longingly staring at this thing that they desire, but probably can't actually attain.
Right. And then that's so much of this movie is we meet characters. I mean, Scotty and Judy, we kind of see them on the brink of achieving something good for them,
mm-hmm.
like finally becoming happy. Scotty kind of solving this case and falling in love and finding someone he likes. Judy or Madeline, whatever, meeting someone she likes and maybe getting out of this life of lies that she's living.
Mm-hmm.
And then things are just falling apart for, you know, the duration of everyone's part of this movie. And just that the idea of things just getting, you know, we start almost at a great spot and things just descend for this whole movie. And, you know, people fall to their death, or people fake falling to their death. People fall in love.
People drive in a downward direction. And
people drive in a downward direction constantly. And it's just, obviously you saw that too, but for anyone who's seen this movie and doesn't notice, San Francisco is a very hilly place. Everyone knows that, but Scotty,
we've all seen The Rock.
Exactly. But Scotty driving around is always driving downhill.
Not always, but,
or flat or downhill.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't get that shot of him turning up a steep hill, which you think
he's not Steve McQueen in Bullet doing jumps, you know?
Yeah, no, just something you would figured be inevitable in a city movie set in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's always just downward, and the, you know, Vertigo, the fall from grace these characters experience, and as I said, kind of all these jumps to people's death is just this downward trajectory of everything happening in this movie is just something that really sticks with you, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about how gross Scotty is. And okay.
It seems like you find him gross before I do, but continue.
Well,
and,
I mean,
in the end, he's definitely a very gross human.
Oh, he's so gross. And this is already the podcast with the record for the most times either of us have said the word gross. second place is a distant second. Just sort of that segment where, he just walks into Judy's apartment more or less, like he knocks on the door and then she kind of invites him in and, he ends up offering to take her on a date in an hour. And, he offers for a half hour and then they get delayed and then we get that letter writing scene. And that whole scene I find very off-putting. It only gets worse from there. And right when, even when they're just at dinner together an hour later, he's sitting at the table with Judy and sees somebody that he thinks might be Madeline and cannot stop looking at her. And that's kind of upsetting and it makes me feel a little weird. And then from that point, we get to the scene of them going around San Francisco and him buying her all of these little things to make her into what he wants. And there's a really interesting shot around that time where, I mean, there's a handful of them all in that segment, but one of my favorites is the shot of them. I think it's when they're shopping and they're both standing in front of a mirror. So you can see two of them in the shot, two of each of them in the shot, which is fun. And then possibly my favorite shot in the movie is when they're back at the Empire Hotel, which is where Judy is staying. And she walks into a dark part of the room, sits down on the edge of a chair or a couch, and is totally backlit by the green Empire Hotel sign, and all we see is a silhouette, and we see Johnny looking at this shape of a woman, but not a person at all. It's just a silhouette, and it's the worst. And he just sort of sees her as this blank slate that he gets to fill in with what he wants, and it's horrible. And I think it's a really great moment of how somebody that is willing, I don't know, that feels like they can see something that they really want, and they know that they want this idea that they have. They know they want it so badly that they refuse to see what that thing actually is. And I think an interesting thing about that shot is that when she's backlit by that green sign, she's backlit by the word Empire. And I think it's kind of a nice little, the imperial backlighting that allows her to no longer be a person. You know, it's just sort of the white everyman sees this thing, this woman that he has decided is a thing and he will control her. And I felt like that was a nice small touch that adds even more to the pretty repulsive scene.
Yeah, it's just
like repulsive in an extremely graceful way, but repulsive.
Yeah, but no, I see what you mean with the Empire. It's just she's just something to be conquered and done exactly. With whatever you want, and to be made into whatever you want.
Yeah,
it's a lot of that is hard to watch, and to the point where I think people in the 50s were like, "Hey, you can't treat a woman like that." I think that gets the point across.
Whereas classic movies in the 50s like run rampant with domestic violence, but you know, and everybody was okay with it. But Vertigo is the one where they might draw the line.
Even at the time, everyone knew that this is fucking weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so you kind of touched on something I really wanted to get to, and I thought we'd get there naturally, and I'm going to make a really clunky segue to it to make it seem like we didn't get there naturally.
By mentioning it that it's clunky, it makes the segue not clunky.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
No, but I think it's a very central point that you did bring up of this idea of having someone to kind of mold and to make into whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Are we supposed to see James Stewart as a bit of a Hitchcock figure in this movie?
I think a little bit, because the film does play with conventions of Hitchcock movies, no less. And movies in general. Like, there are multiple climaxes in this movie. And I found that really interesting. And I actually just read a piece by David Bordwell about Gone Girl and the narrative structure of the movie, and how it's a movie with multiple climaxes. And Vertigo is very much that type of movie as well. It kind of has three climaxes, two that are very movie climaxes, and then one that is the Vertigo climax. So we've got this, the scene of Madeline and Johnny after he has rescued her from the bay. Interesting moment about the scene after the rescue is that up until that point, Madeline has been wearing mostly green, they basically switch roles there. She's wearing red when she comes out from bed, and he is wearing green because she now sees him as sort of this object of desire, because she has been saved by him. And I found like that was a really interesting visual thing. And from that point on, they're kind of, they have sort of some form of attraction to each other. And we get them on the beach towards the middle, about the hour mark of the movie. And she says, maybe I'm mad, but I'm not mad, and like runs away from him. And then he chases her, grabs her, and then basically says, yes, let's be together. Let's do this. I love you, you crazy, crazy goon, or whatever. And then they make out, the music swells, the waves are crashing in the background, and you can just see the words "the end" fading in on the screen, because that is how so many movies of the time ended. But that's the middle of this movie, you know?
It's such a crazy shot. Like, it is a very gorgeous shot, but then it's also, especially with the music and the close-up and the kiss, it's too gorgeous. Like, it's so fake at that point. It's so stilted.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's another moment later after, right after Judy becomes Madeline again, she finally becomes after he has bought her all of these clothes and the brooch or whatever, and she comes back, her hair isn't how he wanted it. So he gets her to go fix her hair in the bathroom. And then she comes out of the bathroom and finally looks like Madeline again. And then they do the swirling makeout shot that's sort of a summation of the movie, but they're kind of, he's kind of got what he wants at that point, and then that could also be kind of an ending of the movie, but again, there's another like 15 minutes or something at that point.
I mean
we talked about the actual climax of this movie, but we'll talk about that when we actually talk about the effect of Vertigo, I suppose.
I keep coming across
and the idea of, like, the appeal of a Hitchcock movie is the mystery of it, right? And that's why this movie feels weird, because the mystery is not the central part of the movie. The mystery is the weird, or the part that barely matters. But the mystery is often what made Hitchcock films appealing to people. And the mystery is what makes Madeline / Judy appealing to John.
Right. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons people see Hitchcock in Scotty, is because he is someone who's so fascinated by mystery and someone who's so fascinated by the unknown, which someone like Hitchcock must have been, if that's how he made almost all of his movies.
I agree. Disagreeing. I was just explaining.
Yeah, and then we have other kind of Hitchcock trademarks, like the blonde, icy lead female, very deceptive. So you saw Sight and Sound in 2012 put this as their best movie of all time?
Yes.
Okay. And the magazine's editor, Nick James, said that Vertigo was, quote, the ultimate critic's film. It is a dreamlike film about people who are not sure who they are, but who are busy reconstructing themselves and each other to fit a kind of cinema ideal of the ideal soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
I don't know.
Even down to the language that's used in... Scotty's confrontation, you know, did he train you? Did he rehearse you? Did he tell you what to do and say? Maybe not as a director, but maybe even just as a film goer. It's the idea of falling in love with a character, mm-hmm. falling in love with an actress, falling in love with someone who it doesn't exist. You know, I think it gets to a lot of what we love about movies is this, these good looking facades of people who we'll never get to know and never spend time with because they don't really exist. But something being so real and immediate and fascinating about them that it's something so powerful about it.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Yeah, and just what we know about Hitchcock as a director, actually on set, he's known for being very controlling mm-hmm. Of his performers, and particularly of the female performers. And they're often the women in Hitchcock movies are often kind of imprisoned and you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Well, I mean,
tough, awful people, but who are doing bad things to other people, but are also she's just such a victim in this one. In particular, you know, she's an actor for the first two thirds, and then we see the victim that she is for the final third, and all the permanent dissatisfaction that will come with living the way that she has.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, being a film director is basically being an authorized dictator, and combine that with the lack of women's rights that existed in the 50s, and you've got Hitchcock, you know, how Hitchcock put women in his movies. Yeah,
yeah, and even as you said, of the very, very diminished agency of women in this time, this movie is kind of about just men playing with each other with a female as a pawn.
Yeah.
In the story about Carlotta, you know, her husband just took her kid, and then, you know, that was it, because you had that the power is something that's talked about.
Yeah.
So she eventually just walked the streets looking for a child and killed herself. Mm-hmm. And while Judy is the one, or Judy or Madeline is the one carrying out the deception on screen for, it's Galvin Allstern who is the perpetrator.
Yeah.
The ultimate villain, no? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. He's the villain of the movie because he's the person we know the least about, who definitely throws a woman off of the roof of a building.
That's the one thing we know about this dude.
Yeah. We get visual confirmation of that horrible act, whereas yeah. the things that John and Judy do is certainly questionable, but less so than throwing a woman out of a building.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the lasting impact of this movie? We've kind of talked about its...
We haven't talked about some of the things that I want to talk about before the lasting impact of this movie. I think one of the interesting things about this movie is the idea of vertigo, is that you know, he has vertigo. We see it in the shots that represent his vertigo.
We should talk about the zoom.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very notable technique where you sort of dolly in and zoom out, and where it sort of fucks with the perspective a little bit. Spike Lee does it all the time, and it's awesome.
I thought it was dolly out, zoom in.
It can go either way. It maybe, yeah, in this movie it might be that. You know,
I think that's what I read most recently.
But... Okay, cool. The idea is that the background moves and the foreground doesn't. You know, like if we're using the Spike Lee example to show that this is still something that is done. In Inside Man, there's a really, like, Christopher Plummer's intro shot is a vertigo shot, and it makes him look so badass. And, you know, other directors have done this, and it still looks very modern when people do it. It's very cool. But yeah, that shot is meant to show that we're looking at very normal things. He's looking down a staircase later on in the film, and at the very beginning where we first see this effect, he's looking down at an alley, the alley that he may or may not fall to his death in. And what we see is this point of view shot. We see something that is very normal, something that if somebody were, you know, Picture what looking down a staircase looks like. You know, it's something that
I'm not scared.
Yeah, it's something that you can imagine very easily. And then what this shot does is totally shifts the perspective that you see this normal thing at. And that's kind of John's problem all through this movie, not just when he's hanging from ledges, but also when he looks at women. It's just sort of he sees these normal things differently in a way that is unhealthy for him and sort of keeps him in this sort of stasis where he's just obsessed with this thing that he cannot have. And the second he does, quote unquote, have it. And I know I'm using icky language, but so does this movie. he looks around for the new thing, I suppose, you know, and he just keeps going. I mean, the circles are a big part of the theme of this movie. I mean, we get that shot of the cut down redwood where, mm-hmm. or what I assume is a redwood, where it's just Sequoia. All of, pardon?
Sequoia.
Oh, okay. Where we get all of these rings around the tree, and we see these events marked throughout, you know, the Magna Carta is signed here, tree is chopped down here, and all these things in between. And I mean, what this movie is really about, and you're going to laugh when I say this, is that time is a flat circle. And and that's these different events that have very different reactions on the world as time passes have no reaction or do not change the fact that this is just sort of a circular motion that we're going and the time goes in. And that's why towards the end, when he keeps talking about the past, you know, he's like, I've got one more thing to do and then I can finally leave the past behind me. And that sort of leads us into the climax of the movie where we're getting him pulling Judy up the stairs to conquer his vertigo affliction. So what he's trying to do is now that he has the woman that he had desired, she is in his image or what he wants her to look like. And now he's going to conquer the thing he hasn't conquered yet, which is his affliction of vertigo. And he pulls her up the stairs. He's like, I did it. I conquered everything. I've got it all. And then she gets scared by the nun. She falls to her death. And the thing that he can now do is, since he has conquered his vertigo, he can go out on the ledge and look down. And all he sees is a fresh problem. You know, like, you can never have it all. And that's what this movie's about. It's about confusing yourself into thinking that the ideal exists when it doesn't. It's right. Everybody's going to die.
Well, in the fact that it's a staircase going up that tower,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like he's walking in circles.
Yes.
You know, he is gaining ground, but that element is something, you know, in his head. I'm literally, he is, yes, going up in another dimension, but this idea of vertigo, this idea that he's conquering something by walking these circles over and over, mm-hmm. You know, as you said, it's made quite clear that he hasn't really accomplished anything.
Exactly. And to continue on with the circles, and we mentioned the opening credits very briefly early on. I think they're fascinating because, again, really is kind of a microcosm for the movie because we start out looking at a woman and then we get a close up of her eye. So, you know, it's going to be about how we look at women and it's going to be about how we look at everything. And then the eye turns into all of these just like twirling shapes, you know, and basically everything starts spinning out of control. And there are, again, a lot of circular movement in John's dream later on after Madeline has died. And yeah, it circles run all throughout the movie. And the idea being that you can keep going around and around, but there's always going to be something from the past that haunts you.
Yeah, and there's kind of this unknown pursuit of the cyclical nature. And I'm thinking of when he is just so adamant about her having that, I'm not sure what you call it, let's call it a circle, in her hair.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's such a point, and he wants this thing so badly, but what he's doing is chasing his own tail. Like he's pursuing something to get caught in forever.
It's just another black hole for him to fall down. Yeah,
exactly. And it's something he really, really needs, and he doesn't see that what he's pursuing is infinite sadness.
All right, cool, Billy Corgan.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lasting impact of this movie is that, I mean, it's more of a lasting impact of Hitchcock than anything. Kubrick and Hitchcock are, I think, the two most influential directors on the directors I would currently call like the current superstars of directing. You know, Spielberg is more influential on people like James Gunn and J.J. Abrams, who are, you know, J.J. Abrams was more talented than James Gunn, but they make sort of more crowd-pleasing type stuff, whereas people like David Fincher and I think Wes Anderson, you get a lot of that in him as well, and particularly Christopher Nolan obviously loves Hitchcock. He loves Hitchcock's love of types, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
sorry, those are the three directors' names I have written down.
Oh, really? Okay.
in the only three.
And I mean, we know exactly what Matthew McConaughey's character in Interstellar is going to be, despite the fact that we have not seen the movie. You know, just because we know how Nolan casts people, and he casts Matthew McConaughey because Matthew McConaughey is the down-home American sensibility, and that's how Alfred Hitchcock cast this movie as well. And what Nolan does is he takes these very kind of normal, and I don't know, just things that aren't too weird, and makes them slightly different. Like, there's that line in the Interstellar trailer about Murphy's Law, where it's, you know, everybody kind of understands whatever can go wrong will go wrong. Matthew McConaughey is like, no, it just means whatever can happen will happen. And it's this slightly different way to look at things that we all kind of know, you know. And Nolan makes the least adventurous visual movies as far as these people go. He's got a very fairly standard style, but it's just a perfect execution of standard, whereas Fincher takes these sort of narrative twists. We've talked a lot about Gone Girl, and Wes Anderson uses a lot of these visual visual techniques as well. He's more a Kubrick and Scorsese guy than Hitchcock, but there's a little Hitchcock in him as well. But yeah, it's just Hitchcock's influence is felt all throughout Hollywood, and will continue to be basically every time somebody makes a mystery film ever in America.
Yeah. And obviously with Nolan, I get a lot of his first movie, Following, which,
yeah, exactly.
It's not a far stretch to see the connection there.
Yeah. And I mean, Memento is basically built around a plot hole that you have to ignore, and it ends up making for a really great movie.
It's a good movie anyway. Yeah. Good. Great. So one more question. Do you have anything else?
No.
Okay. Just in speaking about directors again, and that review I read from Nick James, or at least his explanation about why this was rated so highly, I was just dealing with the fact that this movie was not well received at the time, and then later on became so well received. And I don't think, did we really discuss why the difference in those two?
No, we didn't. I think it's just sort of there's always sort of that feeling of subverted expectations being jarring. And go see Gone Girl with an audience that has yet to see Gone Girl, and you will hear it. We had way back on our No Country for Old Men podcast, we talked about how when that movie ended, if you saw it when it had recently come out, there was a lot of murmurs of people saying, what? You know? And a lot of people hate that ending, and Fury is out in theaters right now, and the whole middle section of that movie is kind of the only part of that movie that I really enjoyed. And I was talking to somebody about that movie, a mutual friend of ours, yesterday, and that was the part of the movie he despised. And it was because it's the part that's weird. It's the part I didn't understand. And it's as soon as it became, as that section ends conventionally, it kind of upset me because I felt like it just sort of, it was doing something interesting and then just sort of stopped. And I think that's sort of, speaks to your whole it's the perfect critics movie, because critics are the type of people that like the weird shit because they see everything. Right. They see so many examples of the standard three-act structure that when something kind of subverts that, they get amped up. And that's why I personally think the if Gone Girl had been released in December, it would have been on average reviewed worse, but because it was sort of the first really good movie basically that you know, that critics were interested in since Boyhood came out at the beginning of July. And then we had August, which was a pretty weak month. And I mean, July wasn't a very good month either. And it was the first of the fall movies that critics were really interested in. I think that gave it a really good bump critically. Whereas I think if it came out in December after Christopher Nolan and PTA put out movies, I think it would be seen as a much more, not middling movie, but less exciting than it was, but simply because it broke from broke out of the two to three months where we get the most standard of movies, it really added to the critical reaction to it. And that really explains how people feel about Vertigo, and it's why Sight and Sound would call it the best movie ever, whereas my roommate would who, and this is not a dig at him despite what we've said about Avatar in the past, might say it's Avatar, you know.
Right. Yeah, so I was just thinking about that, you know, the term a critic's movie. And do you think it has anything to do with Hitchcock being even more solidified as kind of a superstar director at this point? And again, when this movie came out, he was, you know, world famous. This is, it's not like this was some unknown movie by an unknown director at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But do you think kind of knowing what we know about Hitchcock's legacy, and a lot of kind of the people who seem to be critics, at least, who seem to really, 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 really love this movie, really run with that idea of James Stewart as a director or as a stand-in for Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. Do you think just with time passing, we look at things more through a meta lens, and this movie seems better because it functions on that level, and that's something people like to read into movies now?
Yes, a little bit. I don't think seeing that perspective is important to this movie being considered really great. Because, I mean, we saw... I hadn't thought about it at all until you brought it up, you know, and I was still, you know, go back to minute five of this podcast, pretty amped up to discuss this movie.
Yeah.
And I think it just sort of speaks to, I mean, pretty much any movie directed by a white man in a suit that stars a white man in a suit, you can kind of read into the director, sort of thing. And I mean, the idea of the auteur theory really, certainly becoming more popular either around this time or in the following decade. And it's just sort of the way we look at films now. The director is the author of the film, and it's important to reading every film. Like, you can look for your director stand-in in any movie. You know, I mentioned Boyhood. You could see Richard Linklater in any frame of Boyhood if you want to. Yeah, it's a way critics like to look at films because it sort of helps make them, grounds them a bit. And like you were saying about looking at somebody from a distance, it allows them to think they know that their favorite director a bit better, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com. We don't know what we'll be talking about next week, but we'll be talking into microphones about a movie, most likely. Yeah, time is a flat circle. Just keep living. All right.
's for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.